I'd like to thank you all for coming, and I think we should begin. Maybe we should get started, I think, because we'll run out of time for Carol if we don't begin. Thank you all for coming. This is the first main event we've put on since the holiday break, and so it's nice to see you all back. I thought in January we would make an effort to feature our own, partly guarding against the weather, but also because we have a number of senior colleagues who brought out important books in this past year. And so today is the first of several events where we're featuring some of our own colleagues who brought out new volumes, and in a few weeks we'll do the same with John Mueller's new book. Carol was last year in Australia most of the year, and in the fall at the Wilson Center in Washington. So we're really happy to have her back and featuring her in one of her early debut appearances as she's coming back to the campus. For those of you who don't know Carol, she's been on the campus now more than a decade. She came from the University of North Carolina, and before that taught a variety of places, including the State University of New York and Connecticut College. She is the director of our project on international diplomatic history and has created, along with her students, a wonderful website which is becoming a clearinghouse for international historians far and wide, and we're very proud of that. We're also very happy that she's taking the lead on a new project here at Mershon on Ostpolitik. And maybe the other side of Ostpolitik is a way to describe this, and it is the world's reaction to the German policy, and she's been working with a variety of people, including the Ostpolitik and Detente Center at Mannheim and a variety of others, and we'll be off to Moscow before the spring is out to round up the Soviet side of this. So stay tuned, because a year from now or so, we'll be doing a very major project on that here. Today, she's going to speak about her book over here, Defending the Rights of Others, and it's a timely book. I won't move your place mark. That Cambridge brought out. It's certainly not her first book, but it's her most recent one. And it's an important book, and I think it's a really timely book for all of us at Mershon. What Carol asks in this book is, how does the world system react when empires collapse, states are formed, and inevitably minority communities are in some ways defined and then searching for their own influence and power? She makes, at the end of the book, some comparisons to post-Cold War Europe, where the world's empire, so to speak, collapsed again. But her study is the period running up through 1919, when empires ended and states became. And she studies carefully the politics of identity. That's what we'd label it these days in our more trendy political science classes. And then very carefully how the world system reacted to these identity politics in that post-empire period, and created international law to deal with human rights and minority rights. And it's a very important book, and I'm very happy, Carol, that you'll be here to talk about it. So without further ado, my colleague Carol Fink.
Thank you. Can you all hear me? Yes, okay. Well, first let me thank Rick for the lovely introduction, the Mershon Center for inviting me, Julie Rajewski and Ann Powers for making all the arrangements, and all of you for being here today to help me celebrate the publication of my book. If I may, I'd like to dedicate this occasion to the memory of my former teacher, Shiwei Liang, who died recently and who long ago kindled my interest in the history of Central and Eastern Europe, and also to my students who inspire my work. Defending the Rights of Others, the second part of it is the Great Powers, the Jews, and International Minority Protection, 1878-1938, emerged from my great interest in international history, Jewish history, and the history of Central Europe. The topic came to me almost serendipitously just as I finished my work on Mark Bloch and on the eve of my arrival here at The Ohio State University. The larger context is, yes, between 1989 and 1991, When the Soviet Empire dissolved in Eastern Europe and when the Soviet Union itself dissolved, scholars and statesmen look back for points of guidance to the tumultuous period after the First World War, when four empires collapsed and a dozen new succession states emerged, many of them born of violence and bloodshed. One particular concern of the 1990s was for those now caught on the wrong side of the new borders, whether in Croatia or Ukraine, or Lithuania, or Azerbaijan, or Bosnia. These were either former dominant peoples, now relegated to a minority status, or people who had simply gained a new master. Suddenly everything would change, as it had after the First World War, from job preferences to physical security. As the new rulers and the newly dominant nationalities proclaimed mastery over their new and liberated realms, much as new rulers had done for hundreds of years. In response to the threats of violence, spoliation, and mass immigration, statesmen and publicists, including Mikhail Gorbachev, harked back to this period after the First World War, when the peacemakers had written minority treaties for a dozen new and enlarged states in Eastern Europe. Let me just put this up for you. This is a map that's in my book about this belt of minority states that were created between Germany and Russia after the First World War. And my map maker couldn't do this. I wanted flags, and I wanted this to be ironic. But, you know, the Polish state, of course, flew the Polish eagle. But in fact, if you look at the ethnic composition of Poland, only 66% of the country was Polish. Indeed, it's interesting that in these now very distant 1990s, the issue was not only Eastern Europe and the changes there, but also Western Europe, which had long since the Second World War ignored its own minority problems and now suddenly began to face the fact that all over Western Europe, minority groups were clamoring for rights and recognition as well. Indeed, one of the legacies of the 1990s was that minority rights had become one of the most urgent projects of a modern democracy. In undertaking this research, I discovered that there were no good historical studies of the international protection of minority rights in Europe. There were some books written in the 1920s, but none of these was based on archival materials. Between World War II and the end of the Cold War, there was silence. When interest revived in the 1990s, all they simply did was to pick up earlier works, and this was done largely by IR people and constitutional lawyers. They picked up the works of the 1920s and thereby created two-dimensional studies that were old and flawed. I thus began this work more than a decade ago, not only to address the issues of the present, but also to clarify what had actually happened at the Paris Peace Conference. How were the treaties written? Why? What were their purposes? How were they understood and misunderstood? I used contemporary documents. I looked at the peacemakers. I looked at the dozen new states on whom these treaties were imposed. I looked, too, at the advocates of minority protection, largely the Jews who came to the Paris Peace Conference to clamor for rights of their kin. I looked further in the shadows at the defeated state of Germany that was intensely interested in the fate of 6 million Germans that would be left beyond its borders. I looked at the policies of the new Bolshevik government in Moscow, also intensely interested in the fate of land stripped from the old Russian Empire. And behind all of this was an inflamed public opinion tried by 4 years of war and demanding a good peace. I had some background in this. Eons ago, I'd written my doctoral dissertation on Germany's defense of minority rights in the League of Nations between 1920 and 1933. That was a long ago age when all we had were the captured German records on which to base our analyses. By the 1990s, there was a flood of documentation, not only in the West, but also in the former communist world. All of this was open to me to create a far broader and more nuanced picture using the documentation of almost all the parties involved. Like all limited products that we work on, this one took off and it grew. In order to understand the peace conference, I had to range back to Berlin in 1878, to the last great peace conference that had dealt with the minority question. In order to understand the workings of the peace treaties, I moved forward 20 years to the interwar period and to the working out of the minority protection system. And so the book ends up in three parts. The preliminaries from 1878 to 1918, the ways in which great powers, minority advocates, irredentist forces, small and truculent national states, new minorities, all dealt with the problem. The centerpiece is the peace conference and the writing of these treaties. And the third part, mostly a sad part, is the way in which the League of Nations tried to elaborate, tried to protect minorities, worked against the forces of timidity, lethargy, irredentism, truculent minority states in the face of the rise of fascism and Nazism. In pursuing this study, I have consulted public and private archives in a dozen countries. This would include Poland and France and Israel and even Japan. Where possible, and this, of course, is a very interesting thing about doing archival research, one was able to check sources against each other. I remember being in the Pilsudski archive and seeing an urgent telegram from the Poles to the French, urging the French to help stop the war against the Ukrainian nationalist forces. It took me 2 years to finally get to Paris to find out that that telegram took 2 months to arrive there in 1919. Too late for the French to do anything about stopping a struggle that would go on for 2.5 years. Although there is no book on this subject, I also spent a good deal of time reading all the secondary literature, reading memoirs, reading diaries of the period, reading every scrap that I could get my hands on for this history of the 60 years that spreads all over Eastern Europe. And in this way, I think what I've ended up with, I hope you'll agree, is a very traditional, in the nicest sense, diplomatic history that for the first time recounts the complexity of transnational minority protection over a long 60-year period that includes the political, the economic, the social, and the cultural dimensions, as well as the human and the group dynamics of the international minority problem. Did I come up with anything new? I'm often asked this. Yeah, I think I have. But let me just relate a few things. Fritz Stern in Gold and Iron talks about this amazing relationship between Bismarck and Bleichröder and what happened at the Congress of Berlin in terms of the protection of Jewish rights in Romania. I think I deepen this by using the records of the Alliance Israelite, by looking at German diplomacy from a French as well as an American and a British and a Jewish perspective. I have a sense now of what the Iron Chancellor was all about in 1878, both his semi-altruistic advocacy of minority protection and his very quick withdrawal. At the peace conference itself, I think I know more about Woodrow Wilson than I knew when I started, and I hope I will convey this in the book. A man of strong prejudices, scant patience, and very little knowledge of Eastern Europe. Woodrow Wilson, in May 1919, made an audacious pledge for the United States that we would guarantee that belt of new states lying between defeated Germany and Soviet Russia if the new states would accept the imposition of minority treaties. Wilson had no authority to do this. You all know, of course, that the treaty itself was repudiated, or at least large parts of it were repudiated by the Senate. What was Wilson about? It was not about self-determination. It was not even about anti-Bolshevism. Wilson was a conservative man who wanted to create stability in East Central Europe and let the world settle down so that the United States could pursue, in fact, its major interests, which came out of the peace conference in the Pacific. Using Czech and Polish records, I found out that the representatives of these small states were neither as wise nor as horrible as portrayed in the literature. Yes, Bratianu annoyed everybody with Romania's huge appetite, and Venizelos was a pain in the neck, and Pasic made everybody angry at Yugoslavia. But Ignaz Paderewski, the novice piano politician, whom some of you know of, did a very good job at Paris. Knowing as little as he did about great power diplomacy, he was able to greatly expand Poland's borders. He was able to avoid a very serious curtailment on Polish sovereignty. But, of course, the big winner was Edward Beneš, and we can talk about this later. But Czechoslovakia, that creation of 1918 that disappeared in the 1990s, Czechoslovakia, that new multinational state, that Beneš insisted would be like a little Switzerland, was a tremendous job indeed. Two more things I found out. A man named Julius Sobernheim, whom I'd never discovered before, who'd worked for the German Foreign Ministry in World War I, became the Weimar Republic's chief liaison between its foreign policy and the League of Nations and the Jewish world. Germany between 1919 and 1933, and even afterwards, was closely involved with Jewish minority advocates, and Zobernheim, who conveniently died in 1933, not to see the ruin of his work, was a key individual. And finally, in the book, I think I've drawn some of the important connections and conflicts between minority rights and the Middle East, and particularly on the subject of Palestine. And I'll talk about this a little later. What are the main conclusions of the book? What have I come up with? I think the main thing that I'd like to present today is that the quest for international minority protection in Europe and anywhere else involves the fusion of two powerful opposites. On the one hand, the attainment and the maintenance of state sovereignty, which, of course, much eroded today, still exists as a norm in international relations. But the second element is the assertion of outside control. To what extent do outsiders have the ability and the right, as Wilson said, the right to interfere in the sovereign rights of a country, and to what purposes? In this 60-year story, there are five important interlocking elements. First, there are great powers. Great powers in the case of 1878, 1919, and again in 1938, creating new borders, changing borders, altering borders, often without troops on the ground, for the purpose of establishing stability, preventing persecutions, preventing mass emigration. Their goal in all of these cases was to establish a limited form of outside control. That is, nobody wanted physical presence in Eastern Europe. Nobody wanted to set up capitulations, as has been established in Turkey. The main thing was some kind of public stopgap measure, an agreement in 1878, treaties in 1919, that would assure the minorities, that would assure the advocates that justice would be done. One of the most important misconceptions about all these agreements was that they involved group rights. In fact, the great powers went out of their way at Paris to make sure that no minority was ever specifically named. Why? Because if you named a group as a nation, then you might suggest that ultimately they had the right to self-determination. No group rights, no autonomy, no state within a state. Simply individuals who, in a new polity, were deserving of protection, of citizenship, of ownership of their land, of freedom of speech, of freedom of religion. Now, what they did do, though, and this is, of course, important, At Paris, what the statesmen decided was to put these treaties under the guarantee of the brand new League of Nations. To some extent, this was a cop-out. It replaced the individual responsibility that states had had for centuries to look after persecuted people with a collective guarantee in this new organization. Problem was, of course, that the mandate was ill-defined. What they didn't do, and this is also important, what they didn't do was to establish a universal system of minority rights. Paderewski and others were quick to point out, when these treaties were in the offing, that they thought minority protection was a great idea. How about for everyone? How about in the British Empire? How about in the United States? Paderewski offered to send a commission of investigation to the American South when Morgenthau arrived to investigate the pogrom in Poland. In addition, there was the problem of enforcement. Both before 1919 and afterwards, the system was seen not as a process that would ever be enforced, but that would work through a process of moral suasion, the threat of publicity, the threat of attaining, you know, a good name in international relations by following the goodwill of humanity. But no enforcement, any more than there had been enforcement in 1863 when the Russians slaughtered the Poles and the signatories of the Vienna Treaty mildly protested and nothing was done. To be sure, the period I've covered is a rather innocent period between 1878, even 1938, when borders were still relatively open, when nobody foresaw what could happen to minorities, as did happen during the period of the Second World War. The folks who wrote the minority treaties in 1919 thought that states would be civilized, that minorities would settle down, that irredentist forces would be restrained, and by 1938, none of this happened. Two irredentist forces. What is this all about? In the 19th century, it was the Russian Empire. In the 20th century, it was Germany. And now, of course, we have new forces who are mother states in the world who claim for either humanitarian or other reasons a great interest in their kin people beyond their borders. Minority treaties were established after World War I to protect against this threat. And yet, from the start, there was very little protection against this. There was no way, for instance, of curbing Berlin's interest in the Germans abroad, who were threatened by their new Polish or Czech or other masters. There was no way that the great powers were willing either to strengthen the League of Nations system to the point that the Germans would have had a veto or even control over the lives of their neighbors. Some things were tried after World War I, and again more recently. Ethnic cleansing was done in a very polite way between Greece and Turkey, where Christians in the former Ottoman Empire and Muslims in southeastern Europe were exchanged. Bilateral treaties were attempted after World War I, where two neighboring countries worked out arrangements. But in general, the threat of irredentism, whether German or Russian or even Hungarian, loomed largely over the system. Third, there were these minority states, the bad babies of this system, as Wilson kept calling them. The new states, Greece, of course, kept reminding everybody that they were older than Italy or Germany, but they were all considered troublesome progeny, newly formed or greatly expanded, that somehow couldn't govern themselves. The League set up an almost tutorial system with the minority's director traveling 6 or 8 months a year, visiting capitals, scrutinizing legislation. What would they do? They would counsel local administrators on the care and feeding of minorities. These new states were all highly nationalistic, fiercely jealous of their new sovereignty, fiercely resentful of the new treaties on which they were imposed, and more or less determined to ignore them. And this wasn't only Poland, which in 1934 repudiated its treaty. It wasn't just Romania, which refused all forms of cooperation. I could just argue, to be provocative, that one of the chief culprits of all of this was Czechoslovakia, one of the few democratic countries in interwar Europe. But again, as you can see from the chart, this was also a multinational state, consisting of far more than Czechs and Slovaks, whom themselves didn't mesh all that well, but of that 12 million population, 3 million Germans, 500,000 Hungarians, about 250,000 Ruthenians who had no relationship to Czechs or Slovaks and who were bullied and brutalized in the interwar period, and Jews who were denied any form of autonomy. In the 1920s, Czechoslovakia simply ignored the minority question. There's a marvelous document in Geneva where Beneš simply replied to one of the inquiries about land confiscation, "Well, we just don't know where these people are, so I can't answer this petition." Period. End of case. When things got more serious in the 1930s, well later on, by 1936, when the Henlein Sudeten German Party was formed, when a serious petition came into the League of Nations, Eduard Beneš, now in the last 2 years of his rule before his country collapsed, all too late realized that much-derided minority treaty was also Czechoslovakia's certificate of independence. Then there were the Jews, which are a large part of my book. From 1878 on, Jewish individuals and groups were some of the foremost proponents of international minority protection. Why? The Jews of the United States and of Western Europe, newly enfranchised, in the case of Germany, in these other countries flourishing, were very concerned about their kindred in Eastern Europe, particularly about the problem of mass migrations, such as taken place in the 1880s and 1890s. Their hope was, throughout this period, that the peoples living in Eastern Europe could not only stay, but also survive and perhaps even flourish. Jewish groups in all of these capitals, working together, but often not together, were the foremost publicists, proponents, lobbyists at Berlin and at Paris for the rights of minorities. In the late 19th century, of course, the great culprit was Russia, whom nobody could do very much about, except for a few tiny breakthroughs in formal diplomatic relations. Romania, of course, was second on the list and very serious. Before World War I, Romania enfranchised only 1,500 of its Jewish population, which went into the size of about 250,000. And after World War I, Poland became the chief problem, where 3.5 million Jews resided, many of them under desperate circumstances. Jewish diplomacy had some successes. The treaty clauses in Berlin were considered a success. The minority treaties were considered a success. But Jewish diplomacy was also weighted down by several very serious factors. First, after the 1890s, was the rivalry with Zionism. This is important. Minorities diplomacy was based, as I mentioned, on the idea that minorities would stay. Zionism was based on the idea of the removal, the solution of the Jewish question as the removal of as many as possible of the Jewish people to the Middle East. Another problem was the division in the Jewish world about what constituted minority rights. Negative rights, you know, the right to vote, the right to citizenship, the right to free speech, to your language, to your religion, or what were called positive rights that the Eastern European Jews demanded, to be recognized as a people and a nation, to have self-government, to have their own institutions. Also, it was the attitude of the minorities themselves. Within particular countries, the minorities disagreed over whether they even wanted outside protection. The very assimilated Jews of Bucharest, the Wallachian Jews, were completely uninterested in outside intercessors, while the Moldavian masses, certainly wanted and needed them. Hungarian Jews in the interwar period denied that they were being oppressed and refused any outside aid. Polish Jews, at least some of them, certainly wanted it. And then there was the problem within the Jewish world itself, among these leaders, and that was the question of whether it was in fact a good idea, indeed even dangerous, to advocate for Jews in other parts of the world. This, of course, goes back to 1789, and some historians know about this, the great debate in the French National Assembly about Jewish emancipation. Did emancipation have to be earned? Were those O-Juden, were those Eastern Jews worthy of becoming citizens? Should all become citizens? How quickly? To what extent should they have rights? And this ambivalence among the Jewish intercessors was really one of the crippling qualities of Jewish diplomacy. And it goes right into the 1930s. It goes right into the 1930s when the situation becomes urgent between the militants and the accommodators, who are still seeking, still before the League of Nations, still demanding that the League and the great powers keep their promises that they had made at the peace conference. And finally, there is the last element, the international element. Before World War I, and certainly afterwards, there was an emerging humanitarian pacifist movement that included a growing support for minority rights. And this becomes embodied in the League of Nations. I've spent a lot of time studying this much-derided institution and have gotten to know its group of civil servants, who did make, in the 1920s and even in the 1930s, an honest effort to breathe life into this first effort at human rights diplomacy. They read constitutions. As I mentioned, they visited capitals and provincial areas. They scrutinized laws. The League attempted to balance sovereign rights with minority protection. And yet, in that dark palace that the Australian novelist Frank Moorhouse has made famous, in that Geneva dark palace, the record became bleaker and bleaker of massive land expropriations in Poland, Czechoslovakia, and Romania, of massive denials of citizenship to the Jews all over Eastern Europe, of outright acts of persecution and violence that the League was powerless to stop. And after 1929, the League became impoverished, and after 1933, it began hemorrhaging members, hemorrhaging credibility, and hemorrhaging support. Even before the organization moved into its gorgeous headquarters that Carnegie built on the shores of Lac Léman, it had become a degraded institution. Its will to encroach any more on the prerogatives of any of its members in any important area was shown by the sordid deal at Munich when Czechoslovakia was destroyed and the League wasn't even invited. Okay, in the way of a conclusion or an epilogue, what is the legacy of this period? International minority protection was based on a 19th century idea of providing basic guarantees, life, liberty, property, citizenship to minority people in a volatile area of Europe to enable them to live there and maintain. The horrors wrought in Europe between 1939 and 1945, not only the murder of millions of Jews and other minorities, but also immediately afterwards, the removal of millions of people from their homelands, were a direct refutation of the principle of minority protection. Moreover, Hitler's manipulation of the German minorities and the post-war judgments of the failure of the League and the Cold War division of Europe all prevented the revival of any thought of international minority protection for almost the entire second half of the 20th century. And this was not without protest. The World Jewish Congress kept working through this period to revive minority rights. Hungary remained concerned about the fate of its kin people, but it was stifled by the Soviet Union. West Germany, the penitent heir of the Third Reich, simply followed a very cautious, quiet policy of removing what Germans were left from Eastern Europe. But with the end of the Cold War, as I mentioned in the opening, minority questions have come again to the forefront. The Berlin and the League systems have not been revived. Instead, what we have in Europe is a very dense network of minority protection instruments. The European Court of Human Rights, which for 40 years ignored minority questions, is looking at them. The OSCE is very involved with minority questions in the Balkans, as is the EU, and of course, as was NATO earlier on. Not only that, but the United Nations has become much more active in the question of minority rights. The questions that were raised in 1919 still remain pertinent. How do new governments adjust their power to enable minority groups to survive and flourish? How will they even identify minorities? One of the scandals in contemporary Europe is that there are countries that don't even identify the fact that they have a minority population. How will minority groups regulate their demands within the framework of a democratic state? Can you have two forms of citizenship? How will Germany, Russia, and other mother states frame their relations to their neighbors? So far, so good, mostly with Russia and with Hungary, and also with the Germans. How will a unifying Europe maintain the balance between justice and political reality, between issues of local and national concern? I'll give two very quick examples. One, of course, is the headscarf issue in France, but even earlier, the issue, the infamous issue of Ustinalaben, you know, the town in the former Sudetenland where a wall was built around a gypsy neighborhood by the local government, only then to have the force of the European Union come down on the Czech government, force the removal of the wall, and, oh, by the way, the removal of the Czechs from the neighborhood. And the Jews. The Jews, who now constitute only a tiny percentage of the continent's population, are again an issue of serious concern. So serious that in October our State Department was mandated to give an annual report on anti-Semitism in Europe and in the rest of the world. And earlier last year there was a special conference in Berlin of the OSCE on anti-Semitism in Europe. 6 decades after the Holocaust, there has not only been a slow, steady revival of Jewish life all over Europe, but also a looming threat to Jewish existence on the continent. Once more, there is a stirring of Jewish diplomacy, now joined by the government of Israel, and it is mobilized in all of these forums, using new paths of persuasion and pressure in public and in private. They participate in humanitarian organizations, they negotiate directly with governments. It's not all that different from the 19th century. But now more than ever, in the shadows of hatred and violence in the Middle East, these intercessors are pleading once more for the rights of Jews and for all minorities in Europe. Thank you.
Since Carol knows most of you, I'm going to let her field her own questions.
Yes.
You mentioned violence in passing. How much violence was there actually, anti-minority violence, between, say, 1920 and 1938 in these new areas? A sense of either ethnic cleansing or pogroms or whatever, or actual physical abuse and murder?
Well, a lot of the violence, of course, took place in the course of the wars between Poland and the Ukrainians, between Poland and the Bolsheviks. I mean, there were mass pogroms in eastern Poland and in Ukraine. And, of course, a lot of these then, and many of these were brought to the attention of the League of Nations, but the Poles simply said, you know, this is war and this is what happens. It's like the Balkan Wars. People get in the way. But even afterwards, there was a series of pogroms in Romania. There was one in Lemberg in Poland, you know, where simply, you know, an incident would trigger something and, you know, whole neighborhoods would be beaten up, shot, burnt down or whatever. They weren't on the scale of the World War I pogrom, but they were certainly very menacing. And I'd like to add also that in 1923, big time, there were troubles in Berlin itself, in the Schoenentheater, against these weren't German Jews, but these were Jews from Eastern Europe who had settled there. So yeah, there was violence. There was violence, and there were self-defense leagues by minority groups to protect themselves against this.
Yeah. Well, the violence question is how much?
In 1930, the Poles sent an army into eastern Galicia, an army of retribution that, killed hundreds of Ukrainians. I mean, we're not talking about the scale of, war, but we're talking about the fact that people were, in many cases, in fear of their lives. This was not true, of course, in Czechoslovakia, was certainly not true of Romania, but physical violence was one of the issues in parts of Poland and certainly parts of the Balkans, yeah. Way back there, I don't know.
A couple of questions. First, you said the principle of universality was not extended beyond Europe. I'm wondering if there's a single text among the archival material you surveyed that deals with the Sinti and Roma community in Europe, both among the Gypsies.
Right.
I mean, did they ever realize that there's a sizable, vulnerable population of people? Romania, half a million alone, I'm assuming no. And then the second question, you mentioned mass migration, and I know that in the interwar period, the League of Nations in some regimes, let's say, to deal with the displaced, namely the Russian immigrants. I'm wondering if they talked about it at the Paris Conference in 1919.
Okay. These are two wonderful questions. The universality of minority rights did not exist. There was some idea of putting an international system or an international statement into the covenant of the League of Nations, and there's a bad story about that, but anyway, it was withdrawn. This was a system that was confined to Eastern Europe and did not apply elsewhere. Italy was under no regulation, nor, except in one small province, was Germany under this. It was not a universal system. And this is basically what weakened it politically and morally. The Poles, for instance, gave as the reason for their repudiation of their treaty in 1934. When the day comes that all countries accept international minority rights, we'll come back in. What they saw was that the prejudicial nature of the system weakened it. So it's not universal. Sinti and Roma were not included. They were not simply thought of in this way. No minority was specifically identified in any of the treaties. They took tremendous care to do that so as not to encourage irredentism or nationalist forms. But as far as I know, the League did not collect any material about them. And they were simply, their rights were simply not recognized. Now, on the refugee question, nobody really thought in 1919 that there would be this kind of mass migration that happened during the civil war in Russia, and that happened after the wars between Greece and Turkey, where masses of people were thrown out. This created one of the great calamities for the League of Nations, and the hero, of course, is Nansen, who set up a League commission and, invented the Nansen passport so stateless people could have something. But what's really interesting is that under French demands and Soviet demands after 1934, the Nansen office is closed down just when it was most needed in the 1930s to protect the huge wave of immigrants and refugees and people being thrown out that were going to face the world then. No, the authors of the minority treaties, and I saw a very moving document by a British official saying, yeah, we wrote these treaties in 1919. It gave us a great deal of currency, prestige, and power, but we never expected to pay for them. We never expected to pay the consequences. And what you have in that horror year, 1938, is Neville Chamberlain's government putting tremendous pressure on the dominions and on the colonies to think about the possibility of taking refugees after Britain had taken so many itself and France began to close off. And one by one, all of these countries said, absolutely not. They had earlier refused to collaborate They had refused to take Armenians or Russians or anybody else, and they certainly didn't want to get into this as well. It was not a universal system. It was European great powers pronouncing in the name of Wilson some great human rights ideas, but not getting ready in any way, not prepared, not imagining the kinds of horrors that were going to take place. I mean, Kafka imagined them, but he died in 1924. Kafka in 1918 was recuperating from tuberculosis in the mountains of Bohemia and heard the first anti-Semitic cries of his life in Czech, and actually was driven out of his job when his company was taken over by the Czechs, and began to see the elaboration in the last years of his life of these ethnic hatreds. Yeah?
Well, this is beyond the scope of your book, but I wonder if in the UN Declaration of Human Rights, if they're looking at this history and that this entire experience has a lot of influence on the UN Declaration.
There is a connection, and to some extent it's negative, because the UN, you know, looked through all of this, asked itself in 1945, do we have to do this again? You know, do we have to supervise what's left of minorities in Poland and whatever? And more or less, they decided against this. And the movement then went from special minority rights to human rights, and to make them as far as possible universal. And the discussions and the arguments really in the Human Rights Commission were really about that, about not pinpointing any specific area, but simply elaborating something that possibly was more enforceable and certainly that was global. And it's a very, very big shift. It's only been since the 1960s that the UN Human Rights Commission has begun. And this was not in Europe, but in the former colonial world, you know, where new states were formed, you know, out of gerrymandered colonial borders, where, you know, they were certainly not nation states, you know, places like Biafra and other places, where the UN has begun to take responsibility for minority questions, largely outside of Europe, and as I said, now in the 1990s in Europe. Yeah. Peter?
Yeah, well, it seems to me that some of the most complicated ethnic situations in the modern world are in the formerly European colonized areas of the third world, especially Africa and South Asia. I wonder if that post-World War II series of problems is a simple result of decolonization, or if you might find some origin in the policies of the European colonial states in the pre-World War II period in those parts of the world.
Sure.
In other words, were those liberal values that they tried to project with regard to the East European minorities also projected to their overseas colonies, or did they have a different set of values there?
I think there's a similarity, you know, in Europe and the world outside, you know, the Habsburgs and even the Romanovs, you know.